I'd like to ask if you'll play a game with me. So once again, will you trust me for a little while? Okay, I'll trust you. So to begin, I ask you to just put your hands in your lap, get comfortable, maybe gaze down at your hands sitting there in your lap. And start to take a few deep breaths in and out. As you inhale, your hands expand. As you exhale, they contract. And it starts to look almost as if you're holding a ball between your hands. So let's imagine that. Get a feel of what that ball is like. Make some imaginative choices about the size, the shape, the weight of the ball, what color it might be. So maybe it's tiny like a marble, you can roll it between two fingers. Maybe it's huge like a beach ball, you need both arms wide open just to hold it in your lap. Maybe it's oblong, football-like, and you can feel the stitches as you run your hand over it. Maybe it's heavy like a bowling ball, you need two hands just to hold it. Mine happens to be a bouncy ball. Can bounce it off the ground and catch it again. It sometimes gets away from me a little bit. So if you make these imaginative choices, let your imagination tell you what kind of ball it is you're holding. Give it a little bounce in your lap. Maybe it's hard if you're someone with a bowling ball. And then take a look around the room. Notice what your neighbor's balls look like, how they're holding them, how they're bouncing them. And make eye contact with somebody. Take a minute. Find someone nearby or all the way across. Let your eyes meet. Take a look at what kind of ball they're holding. And I'm going to count to three. And on three, we're going to throw our balls into the air toward this person we've just made eye contact with. And then you're going to catch their ball, and they're going to catch yours. Ready? One, two, three. Ooh. That was fun. Thanks for playing. Now you can set your balls aside for the rest of the service. Make sure they behave themselves. Thank you for playing with us. It was fun, but not trivial, I think. I think the spirit of play that we all just surrendered to is actually hugely important to religious community. In my congregation at Albany, we talk a lot about different ways of doing religious education lately. Maybe you do too. We talk about what it means and how we can incorporate the whole family and the whole congregation and how we can approach our relationships with children in the midst of us in the best way. And as we talk and think and talk and think about what religious education means to us, I just keep coming back to the same thought, and that's this. Children are people. It doesn't sound that radical. In fact, it seems like it should be pretty obvious. But after seminary courses on religious education, serving as an RE volunteer, a decade of helping run a summer camp for youth, a previous job as a kindergarten teacher, and most importantly, having been a child, I still think the clearest and simplest summary of my theological perspective on children is that, yes, children are people. This isn't as obvious a truth as it would seem. We tend to shuffle children into a physical, legal, and even spiritual category of not yetness. The de facto approach toward children is as pre-people, creatures in the state of becoming people. And we tend to consider it our job to help them become who they will be. I know from personal experience how hard it is to remember, so here's that earth-shattering fact again. Children are already people. We can let them lead and follow in community with the rest of us people, care and be cared for, and be seen as having the very same inherent worth and dignity as the rest of us people. So I have to ask myself, if this simple statement is the center of how I'd like to think about the young people among us, how could the children in our communities be helping us become who we will be? What do they have to teach us as adults? And I think that one big contribution is to help us to realize the spiritual value of play. Children get play. They get how important it is. They're good at it. Or maybe they get that it's not about being good or bad at anything, but it is how we grow. And not just how they grow, but how we grow. Play is how all creatures grow. Human and non-human, brand new babies and ancient elders. There are a few major reasons why I believe play is so essential to a spiritual discipline, a spiritual life. It's fundamental to being human. Play is the way that we adapt and grow. It's fundamental to being a creature. Even when we try not to play as adults, because adulthood is serious, we can't help it. Once a seminary professor of mine suggested in class that prayer was like a form of play. Think about the elements of play, she said. It's creative, it's imaginative, it's improvisational, and it's a tool for our own growth. One of my fellow students disagreed. He said, but when I'm in prayer, it's serious. I'm serious. I take it very seriously. I'm not playing. The professor smiled a little bit and said, of course, it's play and it's serious. And so I thought back on the hours that I watched children play as a kindergarten teacher. Have you ever watched a child playing with blocks? As an example, she moves them in a little truck from one corner of the room to the other. She stacks them carefully in towers and rows and walls. She constructs new worlds out of them. She smashes her project and begins again because her focus is on the play and not the product. It's serious business. And when she learns it's time to stop playing, you can see how seriously she really takes it. Of course, play is serious. It's her job. It's also our job. It may be the most important thing that humans do. As a church in the 21st century, I think this is a particularly important and serious job. Most churches in the U.S. have spent the last few decades reeling in a period of religious decline. Attendance has largely dropped. Americans report being less religious than ever. And churches are struggling to figure out how to function without the membership and pledge dollars that they once counted on. It can be a scary time for us. We don't know what the future looks like, but we know it won't look like more of the same. And we won't be able to keep being churches in the ways that we always have. What a blessedly childlike place to be in, right? We don't know what the future looks like, but we know it won't look like more of the same. This is exactly the space of play, a space where we have room to improvise, imagine, and create because the future is unscripted. A space where, a little terrifyingly, routine and order and making sure we don't get it wrong are dropped to make room for our wild imagination. Doesn't that just give you a roller coaster rush of fear mixed with delight? Maybe it's mostly fear, but I hope we can get to delight. I used to teach social media workshops for church leaders, and it was usually fun for me, but I could tell it was often frustrating for many of the leaders I was working with. They'd feel worried that as soon as they could learn the layout of Facebook, exactly where the buttons they needed to click on were, how to make a comment on Instagram, or let's be honest, sometimes how to just open a browser on their computer, it would all change. And I started to feel frustrated in these workshops myself. I'm not proud to admit it, but I quietly blamed the participants' age. They were mostly older than I am, as many church leaders are. And I'm even less proud to admit that I let these lessons represent a microcosm of the church world, quickly becoming irrelevant out of an obstinate refusal to learn and grow, I thought. I started to think, ridiculously, that the participants' age prevented them from learning a technological skill, from getting it right, as if people of all ages haven't been learning new technological skills since an ape first creatively used a stick to coax some ants out of their anthill. So one day I was chatting on the phone with my mom, and she mentioned how excited she was about the newest version of the iPhone. She couldn't wait to get it and try it out. And suddenly, I was at odds with myself. She was the same age as most of the church folks who were struggling in these lessons with me. But she was thrilled, not terrified, thinking about learning a new technological skill, exploring a new media platform. I asked her how she got to be so tech savvy, having grown up before the digital revolution. And she said, "I'm not really tech savvy. I don't have any special skills. I just think it's fun to try and explore and learn new things." The only skill she had was play. She approached new and foreign experiences with an attitude of playfulness. It made her adaptable, and it allowed her to grow. So I threw out all my lessons on which button to click and how exactly to post a picture to Instagram. I started using these leadership workshops instead to talk about cultivating a playful and adaptive attitude, that there is no doing it right. Use social media marketing or don't, I'd say, but don't use it with a fear of being wrong. Those church leaders really, really won't destroy the internet by taking a risk to play around on Facebook and clicking the wrong thing. And what's more, we really, really won't destroy the church by taking some risks and playfully considering different ways of being together. We might just grow a little. Another reason I think play is so critical to our being spiritual people is that it happens in our bodies. Of course, everything we do happens in our bodies, but play makes it impossible for us to pretend we are not embodied. A stance of playfulness and creative risk is, at least for many of us, our orientation toward the world in childhood, but we learn to forget most of it by the time we're adults. Adulthood in our culture reorients us away from imagination and toward reason, away from creative risk and toward caution, away from play and toward productivity, away from our bodies and toward a disembodied concept of mind. In a spirituality that claims children are people, that lets children lead us, the misguided assessment of them as pre-people might even be flipped. Instead, we might consider looking at many of us adults as post-people, people who've turned away from their capacity for a full and embodied spirituality. We work hard at the opposite, often, in adulthood, right? We construct a division of our bodies from our souls, of us from the other, of each little piece of creation from the whole. Some of the loudest cultural messages that we receive about ourselves work against a self-conception of being bodies, a mode of existence that's embodied, an awakeness to the reality of our interconnection in one big body of life. In reality, we think and laugh and feel and pray and play and love as bodies. Practices like dance, touch, and play are rarely part of our religious life, and they're sometimes belittled in our culture by those of us who want to either treat the body and its desires as sinful or who want to minister solely to enlightened minds. But I believe they're essential. The imaginative capacity of a child is, I think, a highly spiritual trait. It is the place from which all of us pray, imagine different understandings of the nature of the divine and the universe, and relate to one another in our interconnection. It is the place from which all our deepest questions arise, because it is what opens us up in wonder toward the universe. A mentor of mine, Dr. James Evans, said to me on the first day that I met him, "Spirituality is an engagement in the possibility that you might be wrong. It opens us to the unknown." Theology, he said, is not a doctrinal defense or a road to the proof of God. It's made up of questions that occupy us. More questions, not more knowledge, are what a religious life has to offer. The work of theology is not to gather up knowledge, but to orient us in wonder toward the unknown. We are our most spiritual selves when we sit in that place of uncertainty. And that's the final reason why I think play is so vital. It requires uncertainty of us. It helps us retain a position of curiosity to the cosmos and creative imagination to creation. Neurologists who wanted to study creativity in the brain asked some jazz musicians in a study to sit in a giant MRI and jam together. So they improvised musically while the scientists watched what happened in their brains. And what they found was this: while they were playing, the brain areas associated with creativity lit up on the MRI, just like they expected. But unexpectedly, parts of the frontal lobe were quieted. This is the area of the brain associated with risk management, self-assessment, self-monitoring, and it shut down when they were improvising together. When they started to creatively improvise, to play, the musicians let go of their thoughts about what they might look like, if they made mistakes, their sense of a risk of failure. They let go of not being wrong. And I think this is a religious act. When Muslims pray, they kneel and press their foreheads to the ground. And I once asked my friend Ralph, a Muslim chaplain, about why this posture is a part of prayer. And he told me, of course, there are many different reasons for it, but for him, he thought about it as lowering his frontal lobe to the ground, as a symbolic act of letting go of his own self-assessment, his own fear of failure and risk, in a surrender to the larger whole. It's an acknowledgement of his own uncertainty and the freedom that letting go of being right delivers. To my mind, that kind of prayer is play. It's serious and it's important. And it's play. So I have one final story on this. When my grandmother's dementia seemed to carry her away from us at the end of her days, we found that play was the only lasting way of connecting with her. Trying to reorient her to reason was painful and eventually impossible. Instead, life with her became an improv game. A never-ending yes and. When she said that secret agents monitoring her nursing home required her to wear only one color at a time, what could we do but help her sort her clothes into a red drawer, a blue drawer, a yellow drawer? Yes and. Eventually, she lost all language except the lyrics to songs that were so embedded in her body that they just spilled out of her, usually at the least appropriate times. She'd burst into song in a doctor's waiting room. At first, we tried shushing her. We'd explain that this wasn't the right place or the right time for singing, or we rolled our eyes and tried to ignore it. And then one day, she let loose with joy to the world at the dinner table in the middle of summer. And my aunt, her eldest daughter, just shrugged and started singing along. Yes, and. So one by one, we all did too. We played along. And my grandmother grinned, It was our last vestige of connection with her, to sing loudly together in unexpected places. We sang Joy to the World at her funeral in February. The church was filled with giggles as we learned a lesson from a playful universe. Even our grief can live in this space, maybe only in that space of wonder that is made possible by uncertainty. This is why play is so important to our spiritual selves, why we have to be able to imagine, to improvise, to create, because at the heart of everything, there is something unknowable, a void into which we can't see. We can't break down this mystery into orderly doctrine and belief because it's unbreakable. And this is what I believe. We are religious people, spiritual people, not when we hold firmly to the ground of proof, but when we decide to lean in to that roller coaster feeling, playfully leaping off the ledge into the abyss. Of course, I might be wrong, and I'm okay with that.